A Kinder World Audio presents The Dishwasher's Son by Mike J. Quinn. Read by Mike J. Quinn. Sound recording copyright 2013, Mike J. Quinn. All rights reserved. To the Mexiquins. This book is dedicated to my family and all other multinational families around the world who are struggling to preserve their family bond in a rapidly changing and often inhospitable political environment. When I got married over 7 years ago, it was to a Mexican citizen who had three wonderful kids. I had two of my own, so together we constituted a modern-day Brady Bunch. Since part of my family was Mexican and the other part were Quins, we became the Mexiquins. I love my family very much, but there's a small community of Americans that would just as soon split us up and send some of my family back to Mexico. Don't ask me why. They've never met us, and if they did, they would never guess we weren't all Americans. We're just like everybody else. There really is no other reason than the fact that this small but vocal group is old and cranky and really doesn't want to see anyone else being happy and having a good time. The last estimate I read was there were probably 3 million other American families just like mine living here in the USA. This book is dedicated to us. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. Mark 10:9. About the book. The usual disclaimer. Any similarity between a character in this book and anyone living or dead is purely a coincidence. Although no one person was responsible for any character in this book, the characters and their experiences were not solely wrought from my imagination. Often, during the course of writing this novel, a news event would present a better solution to a problem I had just been wrestling with. Reality appears to be far more creative than I. This may also explain the reality TV phenomenon that's been sweeping the nation for the past several years. Hollywood scriptwriters may have just given up trying to compete with real life. This has been quite a humbling experience. I've worked on this book for over 2.5 years, and I thought I had the story down pretty good, but no sooner had I laid down a logical and realistic scene that moved the plot forward, I would hear in the news a situation that fit even better. Never mind that that situation was well beyond the realm of reality. American citizens accidentally being deported? I never would have believed such an idea had I not read about it in the news and had I not actually Googled this piece of insanity to check its source and authenticity. I would have never included it in the book. It's too far-fetched for even a novelist to present to an audience and still hope to have them find it remotely believable. As it turns out, this was the perfect way to get an Arizona border guard vigilante to the wrong side of the border. And since it had actually happened, apparently several times, I had to use it. When I finished the book, I sent it out to some proofreaders to check for mistakes. When one of the readers told me they liked the story but it was too unreal a situation for him to believe, I was dumbfounded. So now I have to write this preface to explain that this in fact does happen. This book is chock full of irony. So, back to the disclaimer. So many perfect plot points were plucked from the press, I feel almost guilty in claiming this book to be mine. Just like a musician will compose a new song that has never been performed before, there is not one note that has not been played a million times. So it is with this novel. The Dishwasher's Son, Part 1, Chapter 1. One quick jab and the blade slides in all the way to the handle. A spray of warm liquid soaks my hand in the front of my shirt, and the faint afternoon breeze cools it to perfection. That felt great. I thrust again and again and again, and I am now soaked in wet relief against the dry Arizona desert heat. I move to the other side, and this time I shove the knife in halfway, then pull, slicing a 10-inch gash along the side. It's like a dam has been released, and I watch the greedy desert floor soak up every drop. Willie cheers me on. This is my first one. "Consider yourself baptized, kid," Willie says, filling up his canteen with one of the last of the uncut water jugs. When he's finished, he pours the rest over his chubby, hairless face, safari hat, and extra-large olive drab shirt. We will both be dry again in less than 5 minutes, but for now, we're like kids playing in the sprinklers on a lazy summer's day. This is the kind of thing I signed up for. Finally, I'm able to help protect my country from the invading hordes of freeloaders that threaten to ruin it. I'm going to catch some of them before they get in and do their damage. I hand the knife back to Willie, and he puts it in the brown leather sheath that hangs a little cockeyed from his belt. Shane slices open another water jug, making the ground around this water station look dark and bloated. Note to self, next time, bring a knife.
This really gets me, Willie says. Some stark-raving liberal not only put all these containers of water underneath this table, but then he covered it all up with his tarp so it wouldn't get too hot.
He pulls out his knife again and slices up the offending tarp.
What, are they run out of ice or something?
Someone paid good money for this water. There must be 50 gallons of it here, and that idiot not only bought the water, but he had to drive it all the way out here in the middle of nowhere to leave it for people who shouldn't be here in the first place. So what if those rats die of thirst? Serves them right. Maybe they should stay in Mexico where they belong. Damn liberals, I say. Why don't they buy them some bus tickets while they're at it?
Yeah, it makes no sense. It's like going on vacation and leaving your safe open so a thief won't have to go through the trouble of picking the lock.
And don't forget to leave a light on in the room so they don't trip on anything on the way to the safe,
Shane says, staring into his iPhone.
Yeah, ha ha. And tape a note over the safe that says the car's in the garage, Willie grins. The keys are in the ignition.
And there's a credit card in the glove box, I add, in case you run out of gas.
You got that right.
Willie lets loose with one of his trademark laughs. He picks up his binoculars and scans the desert for signs of vermin. I move closer to Shane to see what he's looking at on his iPhone. His thin face and his two-day beard make him look at home in this inhospitable environment. What's that? I ask.
It's called an iPhone, kid. Where you been?
Willie says, walking up to us, his constant grin leading the way.
You need all the tools you can get out here,
Shane adds, his thumbs working furiously on the small screen in his hands.
Want to track down illegal aliens in the desert?
Willie grins.
There's an app for that.
Really? There are hundreds of thousands of apps for those things.
Triple I,
Willie says, as if anticipating my question. That's the name of the app?
Yep. We call it Triple I, but the Mexicans call it Ay Ay Ay. Ha!
Willie says, laughing at his own joke. Even Shane smiles at that one, and he hardly ever smiles.
Let's get moving,
he says, picking up his Winchester lever-action 30-30, his eyes scanning the low rolling hills and miles of flat, open desert. His eyes are rarely on one thing for very long. You can almost see his mind working, calculating, asking questions, and drawing conclusions. I stand back for a second to get a better look at my two new friends and get the strangest feeling I'm in the desert tracking desperados with Clint Eastwood and John Candy. Shane is the highest-ranking person out here, so we do what he says. I make sure my canteen is full, and Willie carves up the last water jug and sets it on the table like an evil plastic jack-o'-lantern. It definitely sends a message. Go home.
Hey, Frank. Why are you out here in the middle of this godforsaken desert instead of in your nice air-conditioned bedroom chugging Red Bull and playing video games? Willie asks.
Shane glances back at me to get my reaction. Because I want to help my country, I tell him.
You're just a kid. What do you know about helping your country?
He doesn't wait for an answer. He just shifts his attention to the seemingly lifeless desert.
What a doofus. Why would I say that to an Iraqi war veteran?
I'm doing for our country what our government doesn't have the balls to do.
Hey, if he were a Miss America contestant, I'd vote for him.
Ha ha! I bet you would.
Shut up! Ha ha!
Willie laughs and kicks a rock towards his friend. Great. I'm coming off as a contestant in some game show.
I work with lots of those rats every day.
And what irritates me the most is having to fire them for using fake IDs, and then having to hire and train someone else to take their place, and they're probably going to have fake IDs too. So I'll have to do the whole process all over again. Forever. It never stops.
Purgatory,
Shane says, nodding his disapproval and picking up his binoculars.
Well, it feels like hell out here. Ha! Willie laughs. I think you're moving in the wrong direction, kid.
Yeah, I'd rather be stranded on a deserted island and have to take a soccer ball to the senior prom than have to keep doing this all the time.
I swear, I'm about to crack up. Soccer ball?
Contact, Shane says. We all freeze.
Chapter 2. Willie picks up his binoculars and looks in the direction Shane is pointing. Another note to self. Get some binoculars.
Yep, good eye, Shane. I see about six of them.
That's what I counted. I'll call it in.
Shane takes out his iPhone again. Wow, there's cell coverage out here? Man, I gotta get a cell phone too.
Why did that Minuteman recruiter guy say all I needed was a hat, good boots, a bag lunch, and a big canteen? I guess I should have known he wasn't very detail-oriented when he didn't question me about not having a driver's license. Thank God Shane showed me the bandana under the baseball cap trick, or my neck would be toast by now, even with my sweat-proof sunscreen. They should have been more specific about hats, too. I'm lucky I even brought a bandana. I was going to just bring some Kleenex, but I didn't think there'd be any place to throw away the used ones. Thank God my hay fever hasn't acted up.
Willie, they want to know if you see any guns.
Guns?
Nope. Hard to tell from this distance, though.
I look around for cover. If shooting starts, I'm going to need some place to hide. The scrub around here is waist-high at best and loosely scattered. The ground is cracked and dry, and it's got to be over 105 degrees out here. How these small trees and bushes stay alive, I can't even imagine.
One thing's for sure, none of this stuff's going to stop a bullet.
You see any packs, Willie?
Nah, looks like a family.
They're probably not armed. Roger that.
Shane slides his iPhone into one of the many pockets in his desert camo fatigues.
ETA, 20 minutes.
Here you go, kid. Your first capture.
Willie looks like he's having the time of his life, but all I can think about is, am I safe out here?
You think they'll send out a chopper? I ask.
They only send out the big guns for drugs, Willie says.
Why is that?
Smugglers carry AR-15s and AK-47s.
Keep chatter to a minimum,
Shane says, taking a brief moment to scowl at us. I've heard of AK-47s, but I don't know what an AR-15 is. I bet Shane knows how to take them both apart and put them back together again, blindfolded. Maybe I should join the army after I graduate high school.
Keep an eye out for immigration, kid, Shane whispers.
Willie holds out his arm and points.
You'll see a cloud of dust coming from the west.
I look where he's pointing and notice the afternoon sun is finally falling. It should be cooling off soon. Shane starts running and Willie and I follow after him.
Shouldn't we wait for immigration? If we don't get on the other side of these guys before they see the dust coming from the immigration truck, we may lose them, Willie says.
After a few minutes, I see a small dust cloud coming from the west, just like they said.
I see them.
Shane looks back to see for himself.
That's immigration, all right.
He drops to one knee and then looks through his binoculars to monitor the illegals. Willie does the same. I drop to one knee and stay focused on the ever-growing dust cloud.
If they were a patrol in Iraq, the enemy would be the last thing they'd ever see. He'll be here in 5. Spread out.
He gets to his feet and runs even faster.
Keep me in sight, but stay 50 or so yards behind me, Willie says. We want to make a wide net so they don't escape around us.
And with that, he's on a sprint too. For a big guy, he can sure move. I have no problem letting him get ahead of me. This heat is draining me of energy. The only thing that really keeps me moving is the thought of the possibility of getting separated and stuck out here all by myself. Finally, Willie stops. He holds out his hand, telling me to stop too. They see the dust. Willie pulls out a pistol from his backpack.
More guns. Great. I look around for a stick. The sound of footsteps racing toward me makes me wonder what I do next. I heard on the news about a week ago a Border Patrol agent got shot out here. I have the overwhelming feeling I shouldn't be here right now. My legs are shaking. What if I can't do this? To my right, the dust cloud grows larger, closer. I'm suddenly hit with a question that turns my stomach. What if it's not a family? Most Mexicans are short. It could be a bunch of short Mexican drug runners. They could all have guns. I hear some yelling and some guns cocking. A Mexican kid suddenly appears running right at me. The fear in his eyes, the desperation on his face. He's a couple years younger than me and doesn't appear to have a gun. This is it. The moment I've been waiting for. The chance to stop these freeloaders before they get into my country, drain our economy, make us take care of them, educate their children, and not pay a dime in taxes. Not to mention getting our women pregnant and leaving them to fend for themselves while they go back to Mexico and come back with new names and identities, ready to do it all over again.
I'm going to catch some
right now before they have a chance to turn my country into the crappy one they're trying to escape. I leap at him with all the hate and fury I possess, from years' worth of anger, disappointment, and rejection, all the materials that a life without possibility of satisfaction can accumulate. We fall to the ground, but he pulls himself free. If I lose him, I'll lose the respect of Shane and Willie.
I'll also have blown my chance to keep these freeloaders out of my country. 1,000 possible failures flood my brain, none of which I could possibly live with. I get to my knees and hit him hard on the chin. He rolls over a bit, and before he can get away, I crawl over to him and hit him again, and again, and again. He has stopped resisting, but my adrenaline is pumping wildly, and my breathing is quick and deep, like I just finished a 100-yard dash.
I hit him in the stomach a few times to stop him from struggling, just like the jocks do to me at school when they have an audience, or when just making fun of my name has lost its magic for them. I keep hitting him again and again, and then I hear someone shout my name. I look up. It's Shane. I stand up and pull my prisoner to his feet. He's crying and saying something in Spanish, but my breathing is too loud for me to understand what he's saying.
I grab his arm and lead him in the direction Shane is pointing. Everyone is gathered in an open area, just on the other side of some short, bushy trees. This is a family. Looks like I got the older son. There's also a teenage girl, elementary school-age boy, a 30-something mother, and a 30-something father. I feel pumped, energized, alive. A visible disappointment hangs over the captives as their fate is universally acknowledged. Mom holds the son I put the hurt on. Dad tries to give me a dirty look without Shane or Willie seeing it, too. Thank God. This could have turned out much worse. What if it had been drug runners? I don't have a gun. Do I need a gun? Did the recruiter even know what goes on out here? Shane and Willie look over my prisoner and then look back at me with pride and confidence on their faces. I'm one of them now. A modified tan pickup truck pulls up next to us. How did the Border Patrol know where to find us? I ask, trying to keep my voice from cracking.
He's got an app for that too, Willie says, recovering his comic nature.
You call for a taxi? The Border Patrol agent asks. Willie laughs, but he's the only one. We all just spend a moment taking in our handiwork. Defeat rises out of the group, and the mother hides her sadness from us behind her husband's back. The wasted expense and effort. Dad's eyes throw sideways daggers at me. Big deal. He's not so tough when he's surrounded by Arizona's finest sons. Maybe next time it'll be his turn. No coyote? The Border Patrol agent asks, sizing up the group in front of us.
He tore out of here like he had jalapenos in his pants.
The officer says something to them in Spanish, and they all put their hands on their heads. He starts with the father and works his way down, tying their hands behind their backs with plastic handcuff things. The older son and I stare at each other for a minute. We're almost the same age. After they're all handcuffed and frisked, the Border Patrol agent makes them all get in the back of the truck. They sit on metal benches and have to watch their heads so they don't bang them on the ceiling. The despair in their eyes is priceless. Soon they'll be on their way back to where they came from. This is so much better than watching the news. I'd give you guys a lift, but the immigration officer nods towards the collection of backpacks, jackets, hats, bags, water bottles, and other miscellaneous belongings on the front seat of his truck.
That's okay. We walked here. We can walk back, Shane says.
Thanks for making this one so easy.
Just doing what our country doesn't have the balls to do, replies Willie, winking at me.
We watch the truck bounce off towards the highway, getting up to about 25 or 30 miles per hour, seemingly unaware there isn't a road out here. Willie laughs.
That right there's called making margaritas.
I watch the truck take a few good bounces and get what he means. There was a coyote with these guys?
They're always the first to run, Shane says.
They get hit hard when they get caught.
Willie shakes the dust from his hat.
Prison time, fines. I hear they get banned from the country for life.
He started running the moment you saw the dust, Shane says. That's why we had to run to get on the other side of him, before this turned into an all-day chase.
You mean he just left his customers there all by themselves? Willie looks at me with an expression of disbelief.
You think coyotes care about these people?
Hell, most of them rape the women they bring here, and the guys just let them do it, Shane adds.
They don't do anything to stop them?
Can't. Without them, they'd be dead.
Willie takes a long drink from his canteen and reminds me I'm pretty thirsty myself.
They're predators. Animals.
Shane's face hardens as he talks. His voice loses all emotion, and a gravelly monotone carries the words over the hot, dry Arizona desert air.
They get paid thousands of dollars whether their customers make it or not, and they take whatever pleasure they want from whoever they want.
He stares out into the desert like he can almost see where the coyote is going, what he looks like, how he's dressed, where he may be hiding. You want to go after him? I ask.
Nah, those guys are like rabbits. By the time we'd catch up to him, the Border Patrol would be back at the station, and we'd be out of cell phone range.
He takes a swig off his canteen and wipes his chin with the back of his arm.
The sooner we bring the military out here and pick off the coyotes before moving in to capture the others, the quicker this whole thing will be over. Nobody will want to be a coyote if they're paid on this side of the border with lead.
It's time to start getting back, Willie says.
Shane takes one last look out over the desert while I take a long, cool drink from my canteen.
Looks like they'll be taking a bumpy way home, Shane says, with just the slightest hint of a grin. We watch the truck bob and toss and turn and claw its way out of the desert. At times, rooster tails of dirt and scrub shoot 15 feet in the air. If you didn't know any better, you'd think a couple of teenagers were out here four-wheeling and having fun. The truck suddenly leaps into the air and lands, throwing a huge wake of dust and scrub high above it. Wahoo! Did you see that? I ask.
Yeah, that would be one of the perks of working out here, says Willie. Four-wheeling on the job.
As we walk back to Willie's truck, I notice my clothes are stained with sweat and dust. I don't know how I'm going to walk home from Denny's without anyone seeing me like this.
Hey, Frank, do they make you learn Spanish in school? Willie asks.
Nah, I heard that too, but they must have just started doing that, because I never had to. I do have to learn to speak it at work, though.
Work? Damn, you just can't escape it nowadays.
Yeah, not only do they come here to get a free education, free medical services, and free lunches, they don't have the decency to learn the language of the land that's giving everything to them.
We should just make them, Shane says.
How?
Just have everything in English, period.
Shane shifts his rifle from his left hand to his right and rests it against his shoulder.
I bet if they had to order the food in English, they'd be pretty fluent in a month.
Or starve to death, I add.
Either way, it's fine with me.
This is the USA, and it needs to stay that way, says Willie. At the rate we're going now, instead of this being North and South America, it's going to be called North and South Latin America.
We all stop and notice the dust storm appears again in the west.
Hey, what do you think they're coming back for?
Willie asks. Shane shrugs and pulls up his binoculars with his free left hand, still holding onto the 30-30 with his right.
That's not immigration. It's them.
Who are them?
Cowboys.
Yeah,
Willie says, looking through his binoculars.
They kind of round up strays.
What did that mean? Chapter 3. A black Ford F-250 four-wheel drive pickup with two spotlights atop a beefy black padded roll bar pulls up next to us. Inside the truck are a couple of rednecks a few years older than me, wearing sleeveless t-shirts we call wife beaters, which give their muscular tattoos some room to breathe. Both have tattoos of eagles clutching things like arrows or spears and an American flag. Each of them has a movable spotlight with big black handles right outside their windows. In the bed of the truck, holding onto their rifles with one hand and the roll bar with the other, are two thinner rednecks. They're about my age, and it looks like they all shop at the same clothing store. There's also a whole lot less of them sticking out of their shirts than the two in the cab, and from here their tattoos look more like crows than eagles.
Seen your handiwork over at the water station, the driver says.
Yeah, nice, agrees one of the guys in the back. Silence. Thanks, I say. Shane locks eyes with the driver, and Willie looks a whole bunch over.
What are you boys up to tonight? Asks Willie.
Same as usual, the driver says.
Hunting rabbit,
the guy riding shotgun grins and spits a black stream of tobacco out of the window, and the dusty desert floor balls it up, making it look like a fuzzy black caterpillar. It seems even the desert has its standards regarding what liquids it'll soak up and what it won't. Each of the skinny guys in the back picks up a dead jackrabbit by the ears so we can see them. They must be 5 feet long from ears to feet. I never knew rabbits could get that big. Leaning up against the back of the cab and tied to the roll bar, I see a pick and two shovels. One of the skinny guys sees me looking.
In case we get stuck out here, he says.
Yeah, his buddy agrees.
We just dig ourselves out.
You got all your bases covered as usual, Shane says, his eyes never leaving the driver's.
Got to, replies the driver. He leans over and sticks his head partway out the window.
Those damn wetbacks won't play by the rules. Who says we have to?
Only two?
Willie asks, nodding toward the guys with the rabbits.
We got a coyote yesterday, replies the guy riding shotgun.
Was it alone? Shane asks.
Nope, I got his friend, says the driver, grinning from ear to ear. Where are you guys lining up these days?
We got teams of threes and fours every 5 miles or so for the next 20 miles, Shane says.
I saw immigration making its way back to town.
The driver cracks an evil smile.
Making margaritas, were they?
Yeah, we got 5 of them,
Willie says.
I told you, Bobby, I told you,
says one of the skinny guys in the back. Any get away? The driver asks.
A coyote, Willie says.
Oh well, One thing about wetbacks is there's plenty more where they came from, says Bobby as he secures the dead rabbits in the back of the truck.
We're just heading in. I imagine the night crew will be half our numbers, Willie says.
Thanks. Okay, boys, let's go hunting coyotes. The driver hits the gas, and the two guys in the back snatch their guns with one hand and leap for the roll bars with the other. They bounce eastward over ruts and weeds and mesquite, leaving a dust cloud behind them. It's a wonder we catch anybody with vehicles. That coyote is probably long gone by now, but then again, that truck can cover a whole lot more ground in an hour than a person on foot. We follow the tire tracks until we're back at Willie's truck, parked by a gate on the side of the highway. We all pile into the old blue GMC pickup that got us here, and when Willie turns the ignition, we're immediately assaulted by his air conditioning, pumping out hot air like a blow dryer. He quickly turns it down and then turns up the country music. From here on out, we're left to our own thoughts with a mournful soundtrack playing in the background. When we get to the Denny's we all met at earlier in the day, Shane and I pile out of the truck and stretch our legs.
Thanks for the training, guys. I appreciate it. Anytime, kid, Willie says. Ask for us next time you go out. We'd love to have you.
I'm sure you'll be better prepared, Shane adds before getting into his car.
Yeah, I got it. Believe me. Good boy. See you later.
Willie waves and drives off. Shane just drives away. No wave, no goodbye. Pleasantries are a waste of energy for him. I want to be that cool. I've about 7 blocks to walk home. My mind is awash with all the new things I learned today, as well as 100 new questions I never knew to ask before, such as, where do these rats go after we capture them? What happens to them next? Do they get deported? Or do we pay for them to have an attorney? When I get home, I shower and heat up one of the meals my mother has pre-made and wrapped for me. We hardly see each other. She works 2, sometimes 3 jobs, and I either go to school full-time or work. It's always been like this. Before I fall asleep, I wonder what everyone at Taco Bell would think if tomorrow I told them I'm a Minuteman.
Chapter 4. I get out of the shower and there it is. My nemesis. That hateful thing. It holds court over the entire bathroom and watches my every move. Hazel eyes, dark brown hair, thick and short like a bear's hide. Pale and speckless cheeks stretched over sad, thin bones. Clean-shaven, smooth skin, not yet dried and hammered by the sun. The once powerful rage of acne has retreated to a few blackheads and scattered pimples stubbornly resisting the dryness of age on spotted, ghostly shoulders. Progress? Do I look older and wiser? Too soon to tell. Part man, yet still part boy. When will I ever grow up? He stares back at me. Silent, resentful. The mirror is a politician, a lying stranger hired to serve a need, but never does. The mirror has an agenda hidden behind its silvery curtain, lurking just below the surface, smiling, barely controlling its own laughter. But all I see is what it wants me to see, what it thinks I want to see, what I think I really see. It serves a secret, twisted purpose, the mirror. I've learned to hate it, resent its fake smile, its mocking eyes. I vow one day to get a new one, but I never do. They're all false confessors anyway, and they weave lies with the truth so cleverly, so artistically, it can be impossible to separate one from the other. Such is the tapestry of life. Believe it all or nothing. What choice is there? In school, they teach that life is binary, black and white, on and off, good or bad. But in the real world, there are many shades of gray. Yet somewhere inside the depth of shaded space is an invisible line that, once crossed, changes everything. Truth can be bent until it becomes a lie. Good things can be used for bad ends, and the good gets beaten out of it. Somewhere, from good to bad, a line is crossed, and binary seems to be the law. Hot to cold, up to down, black to white, hero to criminal, the mirror's where binary meets the infinite palette of life. Like or don't like, hot or not, friend or unfriend. Polite society is in perpetual contradiction with its law and order court systems, where guilt is always obvious, set against its Siskel and Ebert movie reviews, where everyone gets to choose one side or the other and be right no matter which side you're on. When I was a kid, the lies didn't seem so obvious. Of course, when I was young, the mirrors didn't lie either. They revealed the youth I wish were older, the ugly I wish were cute, the skinny I wished were strong, the pitted I wished were smooth, the spotted I wished were not. mirrors tell the truth too much and earn a hard reputation. You begin to trust its brutal honesty, agree with its unfair accusations, and then one day, you look different. The thing that stares back at you pretends to be you, but you know it's not. The man you wanted to be is not there, just some imposter pretending to be you, the person you always knew deep down inside you would become. He is neither rich nor easy to look at. His body is not swathed in iron and dipped in bronze. There is no crown upon his head or vengeful sword by his side. His eyes do not shine with the courage of a thousand vanquished fears. I remember the ugly, scrawny little kid I used to be, but the mirror won't indulge me. My youth is almost gone, except for the last fading spots on my nose. Or maybe those are lies, too. And in its place is this loveless thing. Don't look too long and get trapped in its lies. Hypnotized. Changed. Look away. Never stare into the hydra. Never admit the link. The secret. The truth. Mirrors are at least kinder than photographs. Pictures suck the fantasy right out of life. Oh, crap. What time is it? Dark brown pants, dark brown vest, dull yellow shift leader name tag, a gold one-year pin, dark brown tie, dark brown socks. I'm a pauper, not a knight. The promises made long ago, the ones where they say you can be anything you want, are like rainbows. You see one, you know it's there, but the more you walk towards it, the more it laughs and says, I am here, come closer, you are not far. But you never arrive, and the rainbow bids you come like a beautiful dream. I am neither young nor old, I am in the valley in between, the pit, purgatory, just like Shane said. Time to brush my teeth. Careful, don't get any white specks on the mirror. Break its spell, provoke its wrath. Put the toothbrush down and comb my hair forward. Time to go, can't be late. Dark peppermint for breakfast again. Gotta hate working mornings. What is it about mirrors these days? The more I begin to look like a man, the less I like it. Shouldn't it be the other way around? I seem to be stuck right in the middle of a morph, the part where you change from one thing into another, but right smack dab in the middle. I wonder if there's a word for that. I should look it up. Maybe use it in my next poem or story. I take a peek out the window and get more bad news. An early rain is misting down. Summer is ending so soon. Didn't they used to be longer? I gotta get going. In the closet by the door, I see an umbrella and a clear plastic poncho. First rain, a sprinkle really, but it could get worse. Grab them both. The large white box, the one that holds all the shameful things, it's like every time I see it, I hate that we keep it. I hate she hangs on to something so bitter, so humiliating. She needs to move on. I wonder if she'd miss it if it were just gone one day. Hi, this is Mike J. Quinn. I hope you've enjoyed the book so far. For more information on where you can buy the book or the complete audio recording of this program, go to www.thedishwashersson.com. Thank you.